I'm Leslie, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this tour program. It meets at 1 o'clock most Sunday afternoons, and we have a tour program that's led by artists, art historians, and even architects. Next week features Charlie Wiley, the curator of contemporary art at the DMA, but today it's my pleasure to introduce Greg Ibanez. He earned the prestigious Charles R. Adams Award for Design Excellence by the Fort Worth chapter of the American Institute of Architects in 2006. In addition to more specific awards for projects that you have seen around Fort Worth, including Acme Brick Headquarters, the expansion of Casa Manana, both the science and nursing buildings at Texas Wesleyan University, and the office of the Tarrant Regional Water District. He served as a visiting professor at Texas Tech University and the University of Texas at Arlington, and he's a contributing editor for the Texas Architect magazine. But beyond mere architecture, Greg is also very involved in the art world. He currently serves on the Fort Worth Public Art Commission, is board chair for Amphibian Stage Productions, and served on the DMA's Education Committee in 1996 and 97. He's even curated two exhibitions at the Fort Worth Community Art Center. Please join me in welcoming Greg Ibanez.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does that work? Okay. Well, thank you for coming on this beautiful day. You should be outside. I thought maybe, since the acoustically, maybe we'd start outside. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah? Stand out on the terrace.
I'll grab the door.
Okay. And I'll stand down here. Now, I know at least two, but how many people here? Is there anyone else here that's an architect other than the two suspects I know? No?
Oh,
students. Okay, good. Well, the little tour I'm going to lead is strictly my own opinion and interpretation, so you might want to fact check it before you quote it too much as authority. But they're just sort of ideas and things to think about as you look at the building and then also the collection. The modern art and modern architecture, of course, is at this point about 100 years old. I mean, what is capital M modern? At least 100 years old. But it's still the subject of some apprehension or misunderstanding by many people. And you would maybe multiply that several times when you throw modern art into the mix. People are often not sure what to make of it. But in as much as all the modern movements in art and architecture were really had a professed aim in many cases of sort of not looking at the past and reinventing everything, looking at it anew, the reality is, of course, that's not the case. Everything is very rooted in the past, and so you might have a reaction to it or an embrace of it. But one thing that maybe has always fascinated me is, you know, what's the difference between art and architecture or sculpture and architecture, and how might we see that in this building in the collection? And of course, looking at some sources, first the word design, because design might apply in some cases to art or architecture, and I think the best definition of that was by Charles Eames, who said the design is the arrangement of elements to accomplish a purpose. And design always depends on constraints. In other words, there's some constraint or law that it must gravity, function, whatever. And that if things that are designed maybe reach a certain level, then they might be viewed as art. But they're not art just by definition. So, according to Wikipedia, that great source, art is the product or process of deliberately arranging items, often symbolically, in a way that influences or affects the senses, emotions, or intellect. And then maybe a subset of that is fine art, which is defined as an expression of the artist's creativity. Now, what's architecture? Architecture is the art and science of designing and erecting buildings or physical structure. So you have the Richard Serra vortex out in the corner. That's a physical structure, and it was designed, per se, but it's not architecture. I mean, you could live in it. It'd be kind of cool. but it's really not architecture because it's not designed with a functional requirement. It's art. It's there. It's the artist's vision, but it clearly references architecture and many other things. He's creating space. But the difference is the physical program distinguishes architecture from art, and not all architecture is art. I think certain architecture, when it's reached a certain level, then it can be viewed as art. But the self-storage building is architecture, but it's not always art, or the 7-Eleven, or whatever. So, now, the components of architecture, and I'm just trying to kind of set the table, and then we'll talk specifically about this building. Probably the most famous sort of criteria for what architecture should have was developed by a very famous architect called Vitruvius. And it, of course, was in Latin, and it's translated different ways. One is commodity, firmness, and delight. But probably a little more modern interpretation of that is durability, utility, and beauty. It's the three elements of architecture. So durability means the building must stand. It must be built to withstand the elements, theoretically not leak, although that doesn't apply to all buildings. It must have utility. It must serve a function. It has to work as a building. So either you live in it, you occupy it for various means. And then, of course, it must have beauty. And in the last 20 years, particularly in the 90s, there was a sort of an academic debate about whether architecture really had to be beautiful or not, and whether that wasn't just a false ideal. And that's a separate discussion, but personally, I think beauty is an essential part of architecture. But there's a whole academic debate on that. Well, architecture has existed, of course, for thousands of years. I mean, we have examples that are thousands of years old. But if, obviously, it reached a peak in the Greek and Roman era, and they developed a series of rules for doing buildings that were classical architecture. And it wasn't as free as buildings today. There were very strict mathematical rules, which are not in evidence when you see a big house with classical columns in front. Those really are ignorant of those rules, but they are very rigid, and maybe some of you are familiar with, like, Palladio, or, of course, the Pantheon, is the high point of that. But, of course, those types of buildings evolved that way because they were built from stone and timber, but they were bearing walls, and all the weight of the building was resting on the walls, and you couldn't have big expanses that were open without doing a large vault or a dome, because stone, just doing this, it'll only go so far. And so the architecture reflected that with Gothic architecture with vertical windows. And, of course, the Gothic cathedrals pushed the limit in terms of how much stone you could take away and how much glass you could put in by the flying buttresses, which are designed to keep the building from spreading out. Because if you have any kind of arch or vault, it wants to flatten. So it's all about keeping the building from doing this. Well, in the late 19th century, there was the technological revolution, and cast iron, and more importantly, steel, was developed in terms of industrial manufacture. Also, reinforced concrete. Now, the Romans had concrete. The Pantheon Dome is made from concrete, but their concrete was a little different than ours. It was had marble dust, it had lime, sand, and aggregate or gravel. Our concrete today has something called Portland cement, which is very strong, originally from Portland, England. But most importantly, it has steel inside it. And everybody's seen buildings going up or highways, and there's steel. And the idea of that is that concrete by itself is very strong in compression. If you push on concrete, like a concrete slab, it's very strong. But if you just take concrete and you try and bend it, like make it span an opening, it's extremely weak. It really can't do it. So when you introduce steel in it, the steel provides tensile strength on the bottom of the beam, where the beam is stretching, and then the concrete does the compression. So you don't need a lesson in structural engineering. But the point is, this was very liberating, this whole idea. So you had steel, which can span great areas, or cast iron originally, and then steel even farther. And then you had concrete, reinforced concrete, which was developed scientifically. So this liberated architecture. Well, there was a period of time when architecture didn't look any different, but it was still, but it was made with new materials. And before World War I, but particularly after World War I, and obviously World War I was a horrific event in the continent of Europe, wiped out a large percentage of the male population of Europe. And everyone rethought everything. Of course, it all started over a petty argument between people that were related to each other that happened to be kings, and millions of people died over those petty arguments. So obviously there was a rejection, so there was new literature, new art forms came out of that, new art in terms of visual arts, and architecture. Architects kind of thought, okay, this is ridiculous. We have steel and concrete, and we're building these classical buildings, but they're fake. It's just window dressing. The real building is inside there, and it's made from these great materials, and why are we stuck with these tall, thin windows when we can now do windows as wide as we want? So that is highly abbreviated architecture for dummies version of modern architecture, and it's much more than that. But the point is, it was a rethinking. Now, it's important to remember that all the really seminal modern architects were trained in a classical style of architecture. Many of them studied at the École des Beaux-Arts, which was the highest, really the best school of architecture in Paris. And they learned the classical language, and then they evolved. So, you know, you never really forget that. So it's really imbued in modern architecture, even though they said it wasn't. So having said all that, it brings us kind of to this building and modern architecture. And modern architecture, maybe one of the most famous dictums is form follows function by Louis Sullivan, very important architect in Chicago. Frank Lloyd Wright worked for him as a young man and really learned a lot from him. But Louis Sullivan was a highly influential architect who bridged sort of 19th century architecture and modern architecture, and really was very important. His building still had ornament. Any of you have been to like Carson Peary Scott store in Chicago on State Street? Just this riot of bronze ornament, his organic ornament, and it's really where Wright learned that, is just unparalleled. And the Art Institute of Chicago has part of one of his masterworks, which was tragically torn down for no good reason, the Stock Exchange, recreated in the Art Institute. So he said form follows function, And that's a, you know, there are certain buildings and that are just reduced to pure function, and I think none of us find those necessarily very satisfying. And going back to Charles Eames, he said, another great quote of his is, well, who says pleasure is not a function? I mean, isn't that a function, to make people happy or feel good? I mean, we can't just reduce it all to the doors here, it's wide enough, the air conditioning works. That's not enough. So modern architecture has been about that, and also one of the things that is a continuing thread is trying to expose more the way the building's built, because the Pantheon, we all know the large columns, those are about how the building's built. And there's pediments, and buildings with arches have keystones. It's all about the expression of the architecture. It says something about the way the building was made. And modern architecture has been on that quest for a long time. Now, if it's just simply exposing the building, it's not always satisfying. And I think the best modern architecture, it speaks to how it's made, but there's much more to it than that. And Ando, I don't know how many of you know much about him, but briefly, he never went to architecture school. He was a boxer. He was a truck driver. He became interested in architecture, and he's totally self-trained. And all of his work until maybe the 90s was in Japan, and he did a series of very, really just incredible buildings in Japan. And they were distinguished by concrete, light, and how he sets his buildings in the landscape. He became known for putting a building in the existing landscape rather than, let's say, more classical idea of ordering the landscape to suit the building. But particularly his sense of light is sort of legendary. He was very influenced by Mies van der Rohe. And Mies van der Rohe was a German architect at the Bauhaus, left Germany like so many architects, artists, scientists when Hitler came to power, and ended up in Chicago. And he was the one with less is more and God is in the details, is his other famous dictum. And his buildings are very distilled, austere, but not really minimalist. And unfortunately, his buildings have become so, his copies are so ubiquitous, it would be like if everybody painted the Mona Lisa, the original Mona Lisa wouldn't really look that special. But if you're in New York, you go to the Seagram building on Park Avenue, and that building is, you can tell the difference. It's quite amazing. But a lot of the influence of Mies is in this building. Okay, so let's talk about that. The Mies, of course, he was famous for sort of the glass box, which is sort of a broad term, but that's something that modern architects have always been fascinated by. And we can see here with these three pavilions that you have basically a glass box that's very much influenced by Mies and by Crown Hall, the architecture school at the Illinois Institute of Technology, the Seagram building, and then his famous apartment buildings on Lakeshore Drive. And the corner and the way the building turns the corner is a direct homage to Mies. He would always turn his buildings like this, with the walls, with the vertical, what's called a mullion, stopping short, and then an inner corner, and then starting again. So he would never have just a pure outside corner. And this is just part of that language. The concrete, why do architects, modern architects, like concrete so much? Other than the fact that it's a structural material, and obviously we have in the Kimball one of the finest examples in the world of architectural concrete. Well, architects like it for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's this idea that it's it's beautiful. And this isn't like highway concrete. Believe me, to create concrete like this requires so much work and effort. It's not just like, yeah, we just like the raw construction. No. This stuff is carefully controlled and babied as Carrara marble. The amount of experimentation they did on this building to create the right board to form the concrete so that when you pulled the boards off, you got this glass-like surface. And there's a tremendous amount of science on that so that these corners are crisp. It's very hard to achieve that because at the corner of the form, the water wants to leak out and it leaves little voids. Well, if you get the voids, they're very hard to fill without it being obvious. So it's very difficult. But if you look at it in the light and you see it, it's like marble, but it's made by man. It has a grain, it has a texture. And when done right, it is, I think it's extremely beautiful the way it captures the light. And then in the modern idea, it has the other benefit of it is what the building's made of. And it reflects how the building was made. You can see in the concrete the actual methods to make the building. The round indentations in the concrete are what's called form ties. So when you pour concrete into a wall, you have wood and steel forms on either side that are braced to keep it from opening. Well, those are connected with pieces of steel with conical wedges on either end. And that's what those are, that pattern. Now, tremendous effort was made to organize that pattern. If you see just your everyday construction, the pattern is not so organized. I mean, it's usually organized around a 4x8 piece of plywood, so there's a module. But here, every joint in the concrete, you can see the horizontal lines, the faint ones, are the butt joints between the pieces of wood. So, again, it's not accidental. It's very organized. And we'll move inside in a minute, but just one word, and then we'll come back to this. But the glass, the other issue is the liberal use of glass in this building and in modern architecture in general is accomplished, of course, through the manufacture of larger pieces of plate glass. But any piece of glass this large, really once you get above about 10 or 12 feet, it's what's called a curtain wall. Because it's like a curtain. It doesn't hold the building up. It is literally hanging. These pieces of aluminum and the steel behind them are not resting on the ground. They're actually suspended from the ceiling. So this aluminum member here is in tension. It's hanging. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but the force of the wind on a wall of this height is quite significant. Very significant. So hence, on the inside, you see that steel I-beam. And that beam is taking all of the force of the wind pushing against this glass, which is quite, is of course, here in Texas in particular, the wind is quite strong. So the aluminum on the outside is primarily to hold the glass in. And you can see the glass is insulated glass. And then that steel is taking that load. So this is a pretty typical of all modern architecture office buildings of this type of glazing system. It's been perfected, but it's still the same kind of technology. Now, as we'll walk in, but one thing to keep in mind, and I'll talk about it more when we go in, is the idea of the art museum itself is a very new idea in history. And Ando, there's obviously a problem with too much natural light. You want natural light in a museum. We'll talk about why, or maybe why not. But there's always this problem. You can't create a museum that's all glass because the art will be ruined from the ultraviolet rays. And so Ando solved this by creating boxes in boxes. And so you can see, and they're expressed, again, he's explaining to you how the building's organized right here. You see the concrete box inside the glass box. And then when you go through the galleries, we'll see these subtle clues about where the boxes are and where they aren't. So with that, we'll go in and we'll go up the grand stair and convene. Thanks. Oh, okay. Oh, it went longer than I thought. What time did we start? 1:10? Okay. All right. Well, then. I need to get it going. Yeah. Yeah. Hi. I've already scanned in. Yeah. Okay, my voice is here. Now, we're in one of the boxes in the box, and in this case, this space is not designed so much for the display of art other than obviously there, although you could hang art. But so the concrete's fully exposed here. This is a unique ceiling treatment in the entire building. And most people interpret this, and I don't know if Ando has actually said that, as an homage to the Kimball. Although it's a completely different kind of curve. But you'll see in the building the way, Ando introduced natural light. And that is also one of these holy grails of art museums. And that started and I was surprised when I read this, but there's a famous architect from England called Sir John Soane, and he designed a picture gallery. I think it's called the Dulwich Picture Gallery, and that was the first purpose-built picture gallery. And this was in the 1800s in England, and in that building, in several of his other buildings, he created this system where light came from above and was filtered into this picture gallery. And that building has influenced the design of museums ever since. The Kimball, of course, is very famous for the way the light comes in. And there's always been this idea of you should have natural light in a museum. Now, again, that's an idea that's debated some, because when you're looking at older, meaning pre-modern art, it was painted in natural light or by candlelight. So it should be viewed that way. But artists today are working in a studio somewhere and they might have fluorescent lights. But be that as it may, you can see here the way the light is coming in from above and then it's filtered with this fabric. And then when we move in here to the next space, we see it comes in from the side and bounces off the wall. And you can see the heavy louvers up above to stop any direct light. So the light comes in, it bounces off the concrete, and then onto the white wall. And again, here Ando is showing us glimpses of the way the building is made. And here we can see the concrete going up, that's part of the structure. We can see here the way he very deliberately ends, here's the concrete box he's showing you, and then it turns to drywall, very prosaic material, but for modern art in particular, it's frankly the way modern art typically is displayed is against a white wall. That's the way it was designed. This comes out of Museum of Modern Art in New York, out of galleries, and basically modern art typically is best seen against a white wall. Obviously, you'll go to Italy or Spain and some of the great old museums, and the galleries are not at all white or neutral. They're crimson or ochre, and so those reflect a different sensibility. So as we move through, now we're between two of the boxes. This wider area, we're between the concrete boxes, and then we get in here, we're in the box again. Again, here's the box. Inside, we see again the way the light's handled is a little bit differently. Again, there's little glimpses of the way the building's built and where that wall or roof angles up to let the light in. So Ando very carefully exposes the building just in places and always gives you that reference back. So if we move into this space, again, we're between the boxes, and this is one of the hallmarks of Ando, which we'll see again in a moment, is Ando, in all of his buildings, is known for creating fairly interesting circulation paths through the building. And one of the things he always does is take you and give you views of the landscape and then brings you back in. So here we have an example of that. And of course, we'll see it on the other side. And of course, again, that faces west. So that sun is absolutely deadly to art. And so you have to have blinds that you can see through. And of course, the glass in a building like this is highly sophisticated to filter infrared and UV that hurts the art. And then, of course, occasionally you'll have an opening like this, and there's several in the building. And one of the other things about modern art that's different is it's often a very heroic scale, because it can be. Obviously, in 14th century Italy, if you were going to paint something so big you couldn't move it, you would paint it right there. Like in the Sistine Chapel, or it would have to be something that you just couldn't move on horseback. You couldn't create. So modern artists sort of revel in this freedom occasionally to make these sort of heroic scaled pieces. This museum has several, the Anselm Kiefer down coming in. Obviously, those are examples. I don't know how you move those things, but it must be hard. It's Ellsworth Kelly, who is a very interesting artist in terms of color. And just another note about modern art, one of the things that perplexes people about it is art in general has become more academic in terms of a field of study. For better or worse, I mean, you can look at that and you have a reaction to it, an emotion, you see things, but so much of modern art now has become canonical. In other words, some of the pieces make more sense if you know where they fit in an artist's career. And I think in some cases the art doesn't stand alone as well as it might. That's my personal opinion, but we have other people here that are more experts. But sometimes you'll see, you know, there's the quintessential, the white canvas with the single line. People say, well, you know, my kid could have done that, I could have done that, whatever. Well, your kid isn't that artist, and that's important because it came as a series of studies that artist was doing, and it means something. So it's like if, you know, Hemingway wrote a sonnet, you know, it's not very long, and maybe you could have written it, but it's Hemingway, and it means something based on when he did it. So that's an aside about looking at maybe modern art that sometimes confuses people, I think. Okay, let's keep going this way.
Would the architect pick out the lighting? 'Cause Does it pick out the actual lights? That's what I want there?
Well, no, the architect is involved in the lighting integration. In a building like this, even buildings much less sophisticated than this, you have a whole bevy of consultants. Lighting is extremely important, and you have a lighting consultant who will be an expert on light sources and the way they work. Now, Ando has to develop a system that is obviously flexible so that the lighting can be placed. And you can see the channels, which are places for track lights, line up with the louvers up above. They're all on a module. They line up with the opening here. None of it's accidental. It's all very carefully laid out, just like a Renaissance building would be. There's a whole series of organizing geometry that goes into it. So moving here, we get one of the, I think, signature views in the building. Here, again, you can see the module of the building. There's nothing accidental about anything. You can see the vertical supports for the window are aligned with the Y column. Again, here's another idea of Ando bringing you out, referencing you back to that really iconic view of the skyline. And then this Y column. He could have done two columns, could have done one. He did this Y column to support that very generous cantilever where the roof slab goes out. Now, one of the other things that distinguishes modern architecture is always been a pursuit of lightness, trying to make things as light as possible. So you can see from outside and beyond how thin the roof is expressed. Trying to make it as thin as possible. And again, here you see that concrete's exposed right there on the wall. I mean, it would have been quite easy just to carry the white wall over that, but it's deliberately exposed to again show you the box exists even behind those white walls. So you can move within and out these. Inside and out, we get, again, different views. Here's the other edge of the box. Here we're between the spaces. Back into the box. And then, I'll wait for everyone to get here. And I think, you know, one of the truly greatest places in the museum is right here. And Martin Puryear with his wonderful ladder for Booker T. Washington. And I don't know if any of you saw him speak at the museum a few years ago. The man, it was just so fascinating, the way he works, how he makes these. Wonderful. But has there ever been a marriage of a piece of art and the architecture much better than that? Not too many. And here, Ando very lavishly exposes the concrete. So this space is well-suited for a piece like that. It wasn't designed specifically for that piece. I mean, I've asked Michael Opping that, and he said, no, it wasn't designed, but they hung it there for the opening exhibit, and it's kind of hard to get rid of it now. So to me, it's really one of the great moments, particularly from down below. my little speaker coming behind me. Okay. We'll go this way. Oh, there he is. So now, at this part of the building, you get something you don't get anywhere else. And you really get a view all the way through all the boxes. And then, of course, these views out to the sculpture terrace, which, for whatever reason, I don't think is utilized as much as it might be. I mean, they have some great parties there when they have the bands up there. They're wonderful. But I think it's... I don't know what the reasons for that are. It might be hard to control. Might be part of the collection. There's no, it's grass, obviously, and it faces west. And of course, the people that run the museum, every time a door opens and closes, is a problem for them because the humidity levels have to be kept to very strict criteria, and that is part of actually an agreement because many of the pieces are loaned from other institutions and you have to sign a contract to maintain them at a very narrow temperature and humidity range. So anytime a door opens, it's always a problem, particularly here where we have a fairly humid environment most of the time. But this is just a different moment in the building. Again, it's a little different experience you get. And again, where the architect has kind of created these different experiences and this sort of cross-grain approach to it, I think is, it's just one of the things that unveils itself in this building. I might add that this building is, there was a huge museum building boom in the last 20 years, huge. You know, everybody had to have one, cities. And it's often called the Bilbao effect because of the Guggenheim and Bilbao by Frank Gehry, which is the titanium. And, you know, that building is wonderful and unique, but and it completely changed a kind of an industrial town and put it on the world map as a destination. So there became this idea of you would hire a Starchitect, as they're called, to do this fabulous museum, and then everybody will come, build it, and they will come. Well, as usual, you know, it doesn't always work out that way, but it ignited a big debate about museums. And in the 50s and 60s, by and large, museums were generally fairly neutral containers for the art to exist in. And they didn't try to impose themselves on the art so much. Again, the Museum of Modern Art, the original one in New York by Edward Durell Stone, was sort of set the standard for that because it was the original kind of white wall, neutral, unadorned box for art. Artists love it because, of course, their art speaks. Lou Kahn, before he did the Kimball course, isn't just that simple white box. But that collection is so specialized. It was in a home. And he was trying to recreate the feeling of living with that art with very intimate spaces. And, of course, in a very timeless way. So he has exposed travertine and the concrete. That's a unique building. Probably not as suited for, let's say, the collection of this institution as it is for the collection it has. But some of his other buildings, the Yale Museum of British Art, he would have exposed concrete ceilings. And there's other examples, but generally with the Gehry, there became this sort of idea that the museum needs to be a piece of art in itself, and it needs to be kind of something that's saying something. And the artists generally don't like it when you have, and maybe the Denver Museum of Art by Daniel Libeskind is one that particularly is not liked by many art professionals because the buildings are, the walls are canted and, you know, Zaha Hadid also just completed the first modern art museum in Rome. I think it's called the Maxi, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a very, it's a building with a lot of geometry, and it's not just simple. And there's other examples. Stephen Hall, H-O-L-L, is an architect who does very nice work. He did a building in Helsinki, which, again, it's all curved. This is a debate. And I personally think building needs to recede a little bit to handle the art. But there is a debate about whether, should museums really be flexible? You know, maybe it should be a discussion. Renzo Piano, who is doing the addition to the Kimball and, of course, did the Nasher, which, of course, if any of you haven't seen the Nasher, you should go. It's wonderful. He is quite loved by museum professionals and very much by architects in general for his level of craft. But his museums are typically considered very sympathetic to art. His new wing at the Art Institute of Chicago, I find it to be quite nice. But all of his museums are generally considered are favorites of curators and museum directors. And I think he's going to do a great job over there. Once you decide to build that addition, I think he was a pretty good choice to do it. I think he'll do well. Okay, let's move this way, and then we're going to make our way back down and out. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. That's a good point. Oh, yeah. Okay, we're going to stop here for a moment. This is one of my favorite places in Fort Worth. And, you know, a lot of people come to this museum and never know this is here because it's not at all really obvious how you get here. The first few times I visited the museum, I used to get lost trying to find it because if you kind of go to this box in the end, it dead ends, you have to kind of go back around it. But this is a place, obviously it makes sense within the museum. You have a stair at that end, you need a stair here to go through the collection. But the way it's done, here you can really see the concrete, the way it reflects the light. It's really quite beautiful, the kind of polished finish on the concrete. Of course, we have an overcast day today. And one of the things you'll see here, and if you go back on your way out at the gift shop, and you'll see on the right, there are some original sketches of Ando for the building. And there was some, I won't say controversy, but discussion in the architectural world about what some people perceived as compromises that Ando made or the architects say were forced upon him in the design of the building. I don't know if it's a fair statement, but one of them is the steel I-beams that I referred to earlier that you see along the edge. In the original design of the museum, the glass wall had instead of those I-beams, it actually had pieces of glass. And you've seen that probably in large structures, airports. So you would have really almost no steel or aluminum showing. It would be all glass. Because you can use glass to resist those forces of the wind. There is such a thing as structural glass now they make. And so when you're here, you know, you get no view out because they have to be quite closely spaced together because of the height of the glass. And I can see that is something that, you know, could be interesting. On the other hand, there's a whole nother effect that happens with those. And you see it in the way the light hits that steel as you go down there, I think is quite beautiful. And then as you go by it, you get all of a sudden it opens up into these views. But when you're very oblique to it, you see one thing. When you go more normal to it, you see something else. So I'm not sure how much of a compromise, if it was. I have not talked to him personally about that. It's an interesting thought at any rate. But I love going down this stair, and of course, stairs are, you know, an important symbolic element in any piece of architecture. Oh, yeah, he'll come around. He's going to have to go down the elevator. There's an elevator in the back corner. I heard the understand this little world that Ando has created for the building. Here we see the concrete box, and you can see that the concrete box is actually holding up the roof. You see the way the roof slopes down? It's actually, this is not just a decorative element, this is holding up the building. And then, of course, the dramatic projection of the roof is held up by that column. And, of course, it's windy today and overcast, but I'm sure many of you have been here when the water is calm, or particularly at dusk, and the reflection of the building and the pavilions in the water is quite magical. And that, again, goes back to this idea, a modern architecture idea, of dematerialization, where it just becomes pure form and not a material. And that's reflected in there. You notice the cafe, the oval form, the egg-shaped form, that's something that appears in Ando's work. And you have that one, and then where the Kiefer book is a smaller one that's rotated about 90 degrees. Now, to maybe sort of end the talk, coming back full circle to the beginning idea of what's the difference between architecture and sculpture. And Donald Judd is, I think, a really interesting case in this whole idea. Donald Judd was very interested in architecture and did buildings, particularly out in Marfa, that he designed or, in some cases, retrofitted. But one of the things that makes him very important is there's a couple ideas that he expressed, in one in a particular manifesto. His art was, first of all, it was not all made by him. He would design the art, and then, by definition, it had to be sort of manufactured by his assistants or by a company. I mean, he had a company, I think it was a German company, that made, I don't know how many of you have been to Marfa, but all the aluminum boxes, I think those were made, I want to say they were made in Germany, but I think Germany. And there was a huge debate in the art world about this. Now, wait a minute, real artists make their own art. And, of course, Andy Warhol took that to a whole different level because he really painted almost nothing. And he sort of reveled in that whole idea that I can just kind of stamp it out and whatever. But it's interesting because architects don't build their own buildings either. So maybe artists, art reaches a certain point where you can't make it. Richard Serra can't make that vortex himself. He can't forge that Corten steel and cut it obviously you can't. So it's a very interesting idea. And The other thing that Judd, and I think his whole thinking is very important in looking at a lot of modern art, he rejected the idea of really the lineage. First of all, he didn't call this sculpture. He didn't call things sculpture or painting. He didn't really believe in the difference. But he rejected the whole romantic ideal of art, which was, you know, if you go to the Kimball and look at their collection, most of the pieces in there are about creating space. There's a still life. There's a Caravaggio, a street scene. And of course, if you look at a Turner, you know, with the windswept sea and the sky, you know, they're just so wonderful in the way they create a space. And even a lot of modern art, Rothko, if you look at a Rothko, it's all about kind of the space that you